our bodies are incredible, really. They're just constantly sending signals. But what happens when things go wrong, when that symphony hits a bad note? Understanding those signals and understanding them fast can literally be the difference. So today we're doing a deep dive. We're looking at how emergency medical pros, you know, EMTs, sort of become medical detectives.
Yeah.
How they figure out what's happening inside a patient just by reading the signs. Our mission here is pretty clear. We want to get you up to speed on this whole process. We'll look at patient assessment skills, the vital signs, the body's first report card, really. Then the cool monitoring gadgets that give even deeper insights. And importantly, the art of actually talking to the patient, getting their story. We'll keep circling back to a scenario, okay? Picture a guy, let's call him Chuck Mahon. He's got chest discomfort. What do those first responders, say Bill and Dawn, need to figure out right away? Okay, let's unpack this a bit. Patient assessment. When an EMT shows up, it's not just like a checklist, is it? It sounds like it's the absolute foundation for everything they do next.
Exactly. Yeah, it's foundational. Patient assessment, it really does two key things. First, you figure out what's actually wrong. Second, you decide what care is needed, like right now. Some things might be super obvious, sure. But a lot of the time, it's real detective work, piecing clues together. And something that's always crucial is respecting the patient's dignity through the whole thing. Privacy matters.
Right. So if assessment is the big picture, vital signs are like the first set of clues.
Yeah.
The body's way of saying, hey, look at this.
What are these like critical indicators that every responder looks for?
Okay, so the core vitals we always talk about are respiration, pulse, skin, pupils, blood pressure, and pulse oximetry, SpO2. Then there are others we often check, like capnography, that's CO2, blood glucose, pain level, body temp. But the really key concept is baseline vital signs, that first set of measurements you get.
Yeah.
Because that's what you compare everything else to. You're looking for trends, changes. Some vitals you just, you know, look, listen, feel for. Others need specific tools.
Gotcha. Let's start with respiration then. Breathing. What's like normal breathing and when does it scream problem?
Well, for an adult, normal is about 12 to 20 breaths a minute. Pretty steady. The big red flags though, if they're breathing less than 8 times a minute or more than 24, that's concerning. And if you see an adult breathing over 40 times a minute or a kid over 60, they're working way too hard. They could tire out fast, might need help breathing just to get enough air in. But it's not just the rate. We also look at the quality. Is it shallow, labored, noisy? And the rhythm. Is it regular or all over the place? Sometimes you see really specific weird patterns like Haynes-Stokes where it kind of waxes and wanes.
Mm-hmm.
Or Kussmaul breathing, which is deep and labored. Those signal serious stuff underneath.
Wow. It's amazing how much just listening to someone breathe can tell you. You mentioned noisy breathing. What specific sounds make an EMT's ears perk up?
Oh, yeah. The sounds are huge clues. It's like the body's talking. So snoring usually means the tongue's partially blocking the back of the throat. Hear gurgling? That's probably fluid up high in the airway. But this one's critical. A high-pitched sound like stridor or crowing. That means a partial blockage high up, maybe the larynx. That's a real emergency. Then lower down. Wheezing tells you the smaller airways, the bronchioles are tight, maybe inflamed. Crackles, sometimes called rails, usually mean fluid in the tiny air sacs, the alveoli and raunchy. That often points to mucus clogging up the bigger airways. Each sound paints a picture.
Okay, fascinating. From breathing rhythm to the heart's the pulse. That pressure wave, it's a direct line to how the heart's doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where do responders feel for it? What are they assessing?
Right. So most often for anyone over a year old, we start with the radial pulse. That's in the wrist. Easy to find usually. If you can't feel it there or if the patient's really sick, the carotid artery in the neck is the next stop. It's a stronger pulse. Now for infants under 1 year old, we use the brachial pulse. That's on the inside of the upper arm. For adults, resting pulse is typically 60 to 80 beats per minute. Red flags are tachycardia, that's over 100 beats per minute, or bradycardia, which is under 60. But again, it's not just the number. The quality is it strong, weak and thready. And the rhythm, is it nice and regular or irregular? All vital clues.
So back to Bill and Dawn with Chuck Mahon. If they check his pulse, what could it tell them immediately?
Well, connecting it, yeah, the pulse characteristics are instant feedback. If it's rapid, regular, and feels full, could be just exertion, maybe fright, fever, or even early stages of blood loss. But if it's rapid, regular, and thready, like weak, that's a classic sign of shock. Often see that with blood loss. A slow pulse. Could be many things. Head injury, maybe certain drugs like narcotics, poisons, even a cardiac issue. And obviously no pulse. That means cardiac arrest or maybe just extremely low blood pressure. It's a fundamental check of circulation.
Okay. Then there's the skin. You called it the body's canvas. That's a great way to put it. Responders look at color, temperature, condition, and something called capillary refill.
That's right. Four key things. Scare color is huge. Pink is good. Normal. Pallor, like paleness or white skin. Often, vasoconstriction, the blood vessels clamping down. Could be blood loss, shock, heart attack, even just fright. Cyanosis, that blue-gray look, big warning sign. Means not enough oxygen getting around. Bad breathing, maybe a heart attack. Flushing or redness. Could be heat exposure or sometimes late-stage carbon monoxide poisoning. And modeling that splotchy gray-blue pattern, very serious sign, indicates poor circulation. For temperature, you can just use the back of your hand, often on their abdomen. Hot skin might mean fever, heat stroke. Cool skin often points to poor perfusion, shock, maybe just being cold. Cold skin is usually extreme cold exposure and condition. Normally, skin's dry. But moist or clammy skin, that can signal shock, poisoning, heat emergencies, cardiac problems, diabetic issues, lots of things. Profuse sweating has a name, diaphoresis.
Right. So for Chuck Mahan, our guy with chest pain, what skin signs would make Bill and Dawn worry?
If they touched Chuck and his skin felt pale, cool, and maybe a bit moist or clammy, that would immediately set off alarm bells. It suggests his body isn't circulating blood well, maybe heading into shock. That's a really common finding with serious heart problems. Then there's capillary refill. You press on a nail bed or the skin, see how fast the pink color returns. Should be quick, like under 2 seconds for kids and adult males, maybe 3 for females, a bit longer for the elderly. Slower than that suggests poor perfusion again.
Okay, wow. And pupils. You said they're like windows to the brain, neurological clues. What exactly are EMTs checking when they shine that little light in someone's eyes?
Yeah, it's a quick but powerful check. We look at 3 things: size, equality, and reactivity to light. PEARL is a common acronym. Pupils equal and reactive to light. So dilated pupils, really big ones. Could mean cardiac arrest, especially if they're fixed, not reacting. Or maybe drug use, like stimulants. Constricted pupils, tiny ones, might point to a nervous system problem or maybe narcotic use. Here's a major one. Unequal pupils, one big, one small. That could be a stroke, a head injury, maybe even an artificial eye or eye drops. Needs checking out fast. And non-reactive pupils, they just don't change when you shine light on them. Very serious. Cardiac arrest, brain injury, maybe drug overdose. It's a vital neuro check.
Got it. Moving on to blood pressure. That's the force of blood against the artery walls, right? Systolic over diastolic.
Exactly. Systolic is the higher number pressure when the heart contracts, pushing blood out. Diastolic is the lower number pressure when the heart relaxes between beats. For adults, we like to see systolic 120 or less and diastolic 80 or less. That's considered normal range. Now, hypotension or low blood pressure in adults is usually defined as a systolic pressure less than 90. That 90 number is a key threshold. Below that often means hypoperfusion, not enough blood flow getting to vital tissues. That's often the big immediate worry in emergencies. High blood pressure isn't great long-term, damages organs, but low pressure often signals an immediate crisis. And we generally check blood pressure on everyone 3 years old and up.
Okay. And you mentioned pulse pressure and the difference between the top and bottom number. How do responders actually measure BP?
Usually with a sphygmomanometer, that's the cuff, and often a stethoscope, that's called auscultation. You pump up the cuff, then slowly let the air out while listening over an artery, usually the brachial and the arm. The first sound you hear is the systolic pressure. The point where the sound disappears is the diastolic. If it's too noisy or maybe you can't hear well, you can do it by palpation. You feel for the radial pulse to return as you deflate the cuff. That only gives you the systolic number, but it's better than nothing.
That raises an important question, though. What if you suspect someone's lost fluids, like dehydration or bleeding? How can BP help detect that?
Good question. That's where orthostatic vital signs or postural vitals come in. Very useful test. You measure the patient's blood pressure and pulse while they're lying flat, supine. Then you have them stand up. After about 2 minutes of standing, you measure both again. What you're looking for is a significant change. If the heart rate jumps up by more than 10 to 20 beats per minute and the systolic pressure drops by 10 to 20 points, that's a positive orthostatic test. It strongly suggests they've lost significant fluid volume. Could be dehydration, could be internal bleeding. And how often do we check? Depends on stability. Stable patient, maybe every 15 minutes. Unstable, every 5 minutes. You need to track those trends.
Makes sense. So sometimes the basic checks aren't quite enough, right? Technology gives us an even closer look. What are some of these like advanced monitoring tools EMTs might use?
Yeah, technology definitely helps get a deeper understanding. The pulse oximeter is probably the most common one you'll see, SpO2 monitor. It's that little clip that goes on the finger, sometimes an earlobe. It measures oxygen saturation, how much oxygen is attached to the hemoglobin in the blood. Normal SpO2 is usually 97 to 100%. If it drops below 94%, that's considered hypoxia, low oxygen. Below 90% is severe hypoxia. It's pretty much standard now whenever there's any concern about the patient's oxygen levels.
Right. I've seen those.
Right.
But I've heard they're not always accurate. What can mess up the reading?
That's a really important point. Yeah, they can be fooled. Anything that reduces blood flow to where the probe is can cause problems. So things like shock, where circulation is poor, hypothermia, being really cold if the patient's moving around a lot, even dark nail polish can sometimes interfere. And importantly, carbon monoxide poisoning. CO binds to hemoglobin better than oxygen, so the oximeter might look normal even when the patient is severely hypoxic from CO. Anemia, too, can affect readings. So you always take the reading in context with the whole patient picture.
Okay, good to know. Another one you mentioned is capnometry, the ETCO2 monitor, tracking CO2 in the breath. How does that work?
Right. End-tidal carbon dioxide, ETCO2. It measures the concentration of CO2 at the very end of an exhaled breath. It's non-invasive. The number itself is the ETCO2 reading, and often you see it displayed as a waveform, which is called a capnogram, and this is where it gets really cool. Changes in ETCO2 give incredibly specific clues about both ventilation breathing and perfusion circulation. For instance, the reading goes down if someone is hyperventilating, breathing too fast, and blowing off CO2. Or if their cardiac output drops, less CO2 is delivered to the lungs. It goes up if they're hypoventilating, not breathing enough, or circulation improves.
Wow, so it tells you about breathing and blood flow. That's powerful.
It really is. And here's a huge one. In a cardiac arrest situation, if you're doing CPR and suddenly see the ATCO2 number jump up significantly, that can be the first sign that you've got ROSC, return of spontaneous circulation, that they have a pulse again. It's also the gold standard for confirming an endotracheal tube, a breathing tube, is in the right place, in the trachea, not the esophagus. If the reading drops suddenly, the tube might have slipped out. Plus, during CPR, if the ATCO2 number starts to drift down, it often means the person doing chest compressions is getting tired and the compressions aren't as effective. Time to swap compressors.
Incredible. Okay, what else? You mentioned ECGs and blood sugar checks.
Yep. For a really detailed look at the heart's electrical activity, paramedics can perform a 12-lead ECG. That involves placing 10 electrodes, 4 on the limbs, 6 on the chest to get multiple views of the heart's electrical signals. Helps diagnose heart attacks, rhythm problems, and blood glucose level, BGL. We use a small device, usually a finger prick, to check blood sugar. Normal is roughly 70 to 140 milligrams per deciliter, maybe a bit higher after eating. Super important to check, especially if someone is altered or known diabetic before giving sugar. We also need to assess pain. It's subjective, obviously, but we use pain scales to try and quantify it. For kids, there's the Wong-Baker Faces Scale with the different facial expressions. For infants or nonverbal patients, the FLICC scale looks at face, legs, activity, cry, consolability. Helps track if pain is getting better or worse with treatment.
Right. And body temperature, you said our body's like a narrow range.
Yeah.
About 98.6 Fahrenheit, right?
Pretty close, yeah. The typical range is actually about 97.7 to 99.5 degrees Fahrenheit or 36.5 to 37.5 Celsius. We talk about core body temperature. That's the temp inside your vital organs. It's more stable, usually measured rectally or sometimes in the ear. Normally 97.7 to maybe 101.3 F. Peripheral temp mouth, armpit is usually a degree or two cooler. In the field, we don't always get a core temp, but feeling the skin gives a good clue. Really hot skin suggests fever or heat stroke, hyperthermia. Really cold skin suggests hypothermia. Both are serious.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of vital signs and monitoring. What about kids? Are there special things to keep in mind when assessing children?
Absolutely. Pediatric assessment has its own nuances. With kids, especially young ones, vital signs can sometimes be less reliable indicators on their own. You focus more on their overall appearance, how sick or well do they look, their level of interaction, their work of breathing. Finding pulses can be tricky. The carotid in the neck isn't always easy on an infant, so we often use radial, brachial in the arm, femoral in the groin, or even listen directly over the heart, the apical pulse. And a key difference, we typically don't measure blood pressure on kids under 3 years old routinely, unless there's a very specific reason, like suspected shock. Their ability to compensate is different than adults.
That makes sense. Okay, so you've gathered all this objective data, the vitals, the monitor readings, your own observations. What's next?
The next crucial piece is the patient's story, the history taking. This is where the art of medicine really comes in. First things first, you need to establish control, but with compassion. Show competence, confidence. If other responders were there first, get a quick, smooth handoff. Then, focus on the patient. Reduce their anxiety. Introduce yourself clearly. Get consent to help them. Get down to their eye level if you can. Use open body language. Listen actively. Be courteous. Sometimes a reassuring touch on the shoulder can help, if appropriate. You need to stay in control of the interaction, but always, always prioritize safety. If a scene feels dangerous or too chaotic, you get yourself and the patient out first.
Yeah. So the history starts with the chief complaint, you said. Basically, why did they call 911?
Exactly. What seems to be the problem today? Or why did you call us? That's your starting point. From there, you explore the history of the present illness, what's been going on. You also need background info, date, time, patient's name, age, and their current health status, any medications they take, allergies, do they smoke, drink, use drugs, what's their diet like, recent checkups, any known medical problems. Family history can be relevant too. To get the best story, taking notes helps jog your memory. And you use a mix of questions, open-ended questions like, can you tell me more about that pain? Encourage them to talk. Closed-ended questions like, does the pain go anywhere else? Get specific facts, yes, no type questions. And active listening is key. Things like facilitation nodding, saying, uh-huh, to keep them talking. Reflection, repeating back what they said. So the pain started an hour ago. Clarification, what did you mean by dizzy? Empathy, that sounds really frightening. All help build rapport and get better info.
Okay, so it's a real conversation. But in an emergency, things can be hectic. Are there tools or mnemonics to make sure you cover the key points?
Absolutely. Mnemonics are lifesavers for organizing your thoughts under pressure. The big one for the overall history is SAMPLE. Signs and symptoms. What are they feeling? What do you see? Allergies. Medications. Food. Environmental. Medications. Prescription. Over-the-counter. Supplements. Dosage. Pertinent past history. Any previous medical conditions related to this? Surgeries. Last oral intake. When did they last eat or drink anything? Important for potential surgery or certain conditions. Events leading up to. What were they doing when this started? Any injury. And then for analyzing a specific complaint, especially pain, we use OPQRST. Onset. When exactly did it start? Suddenly, gradually. Provocation, palliation, position. What makes it worse? What makes it better? Does any position help? Quality. What does it feel like? Sharp, dull, crushing, burning. Use their words. Radiation. Does the feeling travel anywhere else? Severity. On a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is it right now? Time. How long has it been going on? Is it constant? Does it come and go?
SAMPLE and OPQRST.
Got it.
That seemed like a really solid framework. What about sensitive topics or patients who are difficult to communicate with for some reason?
Yeah, that takes skill and professionalism. You have to stay non-judgmental, respect their privacy, absolutely. Only ask questions relevant to their care right now. Choose your timing and location carefully if possible. And you run into challenges all the time. Silent, some people just don't talk much. Overly talkative patients, you need to gently guide them back. Multiple symptoms, figuring out what's most important. Anxious patients, angry ones, people who are intoxicated, crying, depressed. Sometimes behavior is just confusing, or there might be cognitive limits. Language barriers are common, hearing or visual impairments too. Managing conversations when family or friends are there adds another layer. You learn techniques for each situation, always focusing on getting the info needed while being compassionate. And age matters here too. For kids, get parental trust first. Use a calm voice, get to their level, don't use scary words. Let them maybe touch safe equipment. For older adults, be aware of potential hearing or vision issues. Don't assume confusion means dementia. Give them extra time to process and respond. Patience is key.
Okay, let's tie it all together. Back to Chuck Mann, our patient with chest discomfort. How did Bill and Dawn use all these assessment skills, observation, vitals, history, to figure out what was likely going on?
Right, let's walk through it. So Bill and Dawn arrive. First, observation. They notice Mr. Mann's skin is slightly pale and cool and moist to the touch. Ding, 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 that's an immediate red flag. Pale, cool, moist skin suggests poor perfusion, maybe shock is starting, concerning. Then they get baseline vital signs, respirations, 16 breaths per minute, okay, that's in the normal range, pulse, 84 beats per minute, rate is normal, BUT, they note it's strong and occasionally irregular. That irregularity is another big clue, potential heart rhythm issue, blood pressure, 13290. Bit elevated, especially that diastolic, the bottom number. Normal is 120, 80 or less, so pressure's up a bit. SpO2, 99% on room air. Okay, oxygen level is good for now. So vitals show a few worrying signs, the skin, the irregular pulse, the slightly high BP. Now the history, using OPQRST for chest discomfort, onset. He says it started about 15 minutes ago while he was just sitting working on his computer. Sudden onset. Provocation, palliation. Nothing he does makes it better or worse, stays the same. Quality, he describes it as a heavy pressure, classic cardiac word. Radiation, he feels it moving into his left shoulder and down his arm, another classic sign. Severity, he rates it a 7 out of 10, that's significant pain, time. Been going on constantly for 15 minutes. So you put it all together, right? The pale, cool, moist skin, the irregular pulse, the elevated BP, and then the OPQRST findings, sudden onset, heavy pressure, radiating to the left arm, severity 7/10. That whole picture screams potential acute coronary syndrome, ACS. Basically, a heart attack is highly suspected. This complete assessment, observation, vitals, history allow Bill and Dawn to form a strong suspicion and immediately start appropriate care, like giving aspirin and maybe nitroglycerin based on their protocols while getting ready for urgent transport to the hospital. Every piece mattered.
Wow. That really shows how all those elements, the observation, the numbers, the technology, and just listening, weave together to create the full clinical picture. We've covered a lot today in this deep dive. Patient assessment, vital signs, the advanced monitors, and the absolute necessity of getting the patient's story. It's really this blend of science and, well, human connection.
It really is. And the key takeaway. You assess every patient, you get those baseline vitals because trends tell the story over time. Patient assessment isn't just one thing, it's this dynamic process. It uses observation, technology, sharp critical thinking, and genuinely compassionate listening to figure out what's wrong and how to help, often under really challenging circumstances.
Definitely. So here's something to think about as we wrap up. How does truly mastering this art of listening to the body's subtle signals and the patient's actual words change medical care? Does it move it beyond just procedures and turn it into more of a holistic, life-saving conversation? And maybe what other silent languages are our bodies speaking that we're only just starting to figure out how to interpret?